Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 371. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are Guillaume Veillette.
3 hours to Donkey Kong. I can't wait.
Ooh, yeah, that's right. And James Jones.
Hi.
Hi there, James.
No sarcasm today.
No. So John Lindemann is not with us. He's going to be out for a couple of weeks. He's traveling around the country right now, and we'll be back soon. But filling his place this week, we have a very special guest, someone I've wanted to have on the show for literally years and years and years. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Garnett Lee.
Oh my gosh, I feel like I should have like a sound drop of the cheering crowd. There you go. Take care of in post. Excellent. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, it's our extreme pleasure, Garnett. I've wanted to have you on for a long time, and I think the biggest problem has been that you would usually record We Can Confirm It on Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening, which is around the same time that we record this show. So it never worked out. I can actually remember a time when Billy was on We Can Confirm pretty often, and sometimes he would have to turn us down because he'd already committed to doing your show.
Oh, boo. It's very comfy recording in this time, and I feel right at home. It's natural.
Yeah, it's nice. Nice evening, you know, you're kind of relaxed, you grab a beer, sit down and talk about Nintendo for a while, and that's what we are going to do. So I'm sure pretty much everyone listening to this knows who you are, but Garnett Lee, of course, not the original host, but the most well-known host of One Up Yours and Listen
I,
Up.
I was
and
then, the actual original host.
This is why we fact check.
So what was the story? Someone else started it, but then
I created One Up Yours. I'm pretty sure I created One Up Yours.
This is going well.
I thought there was a wrinkle to this story, though. That was it, Kathleen?
Are you thinking of EGM Live or something?
Well, you're thinking of the original. You're thinking of the original One Up podcast.
Oh.
And so what originally happened was our news editor, Jane Pinkard, had created.
Oh, Jane, that's right.
Had created a podcast, and this was like in 2005, and that podcast she had set up totally, you know, in sort of a model of This American Life, actually. So it was a much different sort of thing, and she did it herself, had completely, you know, set up the whole thing from the ground up. And we got to Christmas season, and she was going out of town for the weekends, you know, for like the long break, and inexplicably asked me, I was managing editor at the time. It sort of fell on my shoulders to like make sure it kept going because it was a project we were doing and I wanted to make sure it got nurtured and all that kind of stuff. And so I wound up hosting it and I tried to do it the way she had it set up and it just didn't work for me. So I wound up doing something completely different and it wasn't intended to be like a, we'll do this instead. It was more intended to be, okay, well, I'm going to do this and we'll keep stuff going. And when Jane comes back, she can just go back to doing her show and this little stupid lark that I'm doing can go away. And instead, the stupid lark got really popular and we had tons of production time being shown up in the One Up show at the same time as well. It's not as if Jane didn't have like a billion pounds of weight on her shoulders anyway, because there was so much going on. And so, I sort of wound up then carrying the podcast basket and trying to put together the show. And actually, if you go back and listen to those very early ones right after, so originally it wasn't One Up Yours. So yeah, right. Originally there was a show and that was Jane's One Up. It was like a One Up News and Gazette sort of show. And then I started doing a show and I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. And having come from, you know, a background of being a sports fan and having taken some broadcast classes back in college and having that sort of desire in background to do that sort of show, I just started putting it together, walking around the office, recruiting people. No one really wanted to do it. I was like, I don't really want to do that. What do you mean? We're going to stay afterwards? And the rest of the idea really percolated because, at, you know, the way you work in the games media business is very much long hours, and you're around the office a lot. And we used to always go down to this bar, and we'd always go down at about, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and have a couple of pops. And as the boys and girls will do, talk about games, because, hey, we're going to have to go back up to work anyway. You're probably working on a review or preview, or there's some video editing to do or whatever. So you go down, have a couple pops, and you're talking about whatever you're working on. And it just sort of made sense. I'm like, this is what we should be recording. And so
I think that was the sense I always got, was that the very relaxed conversational tone. It really felt like the way people probably talk off hours, So it was very, it didn't seem overly manicured. It didn't seem overly,
well, it wasn't. I promise you,
concerned.
It wasn't manicured.
Right. It didn't seem overly concerned about upholding, some kind of, formal protocol. It really felt very off the cuff, and I think that was what was so immediately attractive about it. It was like, oh, this is what people really think. This is the way people actually talk about this stuff. And it's so strikingly different than the, heavily edited, heavily vetted writing that, that guys like you were doing, and we were too, and we still do. But it's so starkly different than that. And I think in the interim, and in the 8 years since then, the writing a lot of times has gotten more conversational because of, blogs and Twitter and things like that. And there's, I think at a lot of outlets, there are, if not an overall shift towards being more casual with the writing, at least there are outlets and there are certain sub formats, for websites, including ours, where you can be a little looser with that kind of thing. But at the time, it was a pretty amazing chasm between what was on the page or on the screen and what we were hearing on the show.
Yeah, we were pretty Wild West.
It was awesome.
I'll give you that. We were pretty Wild West. But we were having a good time. And a lot of that was also, a function of just the group at 1UP, because that was an amazing, amazing team to work with. And everybody was, we were all genuinely friends and having a good time. And there was a great synergy happening there. Let's not bore people with all this stuff, though. Although I agree,
I think people will love hearing this stuff.
I would hope that maybe if there were some influences, that loosening people up a little bit in writing about the hobby would be a good part of it, because that's a lesson that could definitely still be learned today. Be learned today. It's games, damn it. Have a good time.
Yeah, like being more critical and honest about how you feel about something and not holding back so much, not being as concerned about pissing people off in the industry or whatever.
Well, and then there's the other side, which I think that there's also an undercurrent of extreme criticism. Well, that sounds like a bad television show, doesn't it? Extreme criticism. But by that, I mean people who, or just articles that are making a statement and going above and beyond the remote call of what's warranted in a situation to appear to have some, monumental thing to say. There's a lot of, look, I'm not saying don't criticize something that's not good or something that doesn't work for you. I'm saying that it seems like a lot of times when I read and see negative criticism, that the negative criticism gets written with a very heavy pen.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you want to stand out. I understand why writers want to do that.
That's kind of bull, though.
Yeah, that's why you need to.
Why do you want to stand out?
Well, because you want the attention. It's a crowded marketplace. But I think you need editors to look at this stuff and say, I get what you're going for here, but there's a better way to say it.
But I also think, are we talking about social justice here? I think that there's a lot of, when there's a big consensus on a game, you have to try to be louder than, this huge group of people. So I think that's probably a big reason why these articles are going to be a little bit more, heavy-handed, or are going to seem to try to raise more of a fuss than the game warrants.
Well, I'll be the contrarian jerk and say, respectfully, my opinion is don't buy into that sort of clickbait BS. Mm-hmm. Write honestly, if it feels like you're trying too hard, then you are trying too hard, and just like delete it and go write what you're freaking trying to say, and don't feel like you need air quotes to say something. Just freaking say what you have to say. If you say what you have to say, like, look, the audience.
I think in many cases, that's what they're
doing. Maybe. I'm not sure. I think
it's
the audience.
It's about how you say it.
It is about how you say it.
It's audience to audience. I mean, there are some audiences that just live for that stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's. But yeah, there is an extent where people will overwrite, or they write dog whistle articles, or. You can.
Ooh, I want to steal that. That's a good way of putting it. Dog whistle articles.
You can put yourself in the unenviable position of feeling like you have to write a more extreme position than you actually feel, if only because that it feels like in the mix of things, that's the only way you're going to get your point across. And it's a pretty self-defeating approach because you end up writing something you don't believe.
Yes, I understand that.
Oh yeah.
And look, I get
right. I think anytime if you're writing with the preoccupation of how can I get more people to read this, then you're doing it wrong, because that really should fall in my opinion, I'm a complete amateur at all of this, self-trained amateur, but in my opinion, you should be concerned about the promotion of your work after the fact, not before or during. So you should make what you want to make and make what's the right thing to make, and then worry later about how you're going to convince people to check it out.
Yes. In general, I think that you're onto the right direction there.
I find it hard to talk about this topic without specific examples, but we're not going to get into that, right?
No, let's not. So that was the intro to our episode. I love these little surprise discussions that pop up. Actually, that was one of my favorite things about Weekend Confirmed, is that it seemed like a lot of times you went in with a game plan, but it would get derailed because the people on the show were just fascinated by some tangential topic that would come up, and you you weren't afraid to spend as much time as it needed, even if that threw off your...
A, we talked about whatever most of the time, and B, half the time we were drunk too, so, you know, it kind of happened.
There's nothing wrong with that.
And Guillaume, I would say that, you know why we're not going to go into throwing people under the bus? Because then we would be guilty of doing the same thing just for the clicks.
I find it really hard to believe that we would go viral with this podcast. But maybe we can try.
Yeah, I like to joke that, you know, I mean, we make a Nintendo focused podcast for essentially people over the age of 25. So it's a miracle that anyone listens to this. And I'm incredibly grateful for whatever small audience that we have. And what I love about our audience is they're very engaged. They're very, very active, and they're almost universally supportive of what we do. We get very little criticism. Sometimes I actually wish we got more criticism.
Now we will.
Because it's hard to know how to develop the show or how to make it better sometimes, because people are so kind and supportive of us. And I can't really complain about that.
So in other words, they're coddling
you. It's
training.
Yeah,
exactly.
Here.
That's how we do pampered. This. I think it's just that when you do, I mean, this show is almost 7 years old itself. And I think when you do a show for that long, all the people who are only somewhat interested in what you do or only partially enthusiastic about what's going on will over time, they will drop off, and you're left with the people who are just really into it.
And so you have the absolute core player.
I think so. Yeah. Nice. But still with diverse opinions, actually. I mean, we do tons of listener interaction, and I'm always impressed at the variety of games that people are playing and the variety of opinions and reactions that we get on all these different topics that we talk about. So I don't think Nintendo fans are monolithic by any means. I think we are as self-introspective and contentious and as analytical of a group as you might ever see. And especially when, you know, the things we're interested in aren't going over all that well. I think we have an uncanny ability to look at these situations and say, why isn't this working? What's going on here? And especially because, those questions are either a lot of times not picked up by sort of multi-platform avenues as much as we would like, or when they are, sometimes the people there don't really seem as well informed as they should be to discuss that topic, which is tough for me to say because a lot of times I don't feel well enough informed, but we do our best, you know?
Yeah, we pretend to be informed.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, we put on a brave face.
If it makes you feel any better. As a reader of a lot of business journals, it's the same for every industry. Every industry has its ill-informed writers.
Oh, yeah. No, I believe it. So, hey, why don't we talk about games?
Games.
So
we're going
to, yeah. So our opening feature here on most episodes is called New Business, and it's basically what you've been playing with a different name. You can thank our buddy Carl for that. He, the former host of the show. James, I thought maybe you could start off. I think you've played the newest game of all of us.
I have. So I've only had a little bit of time with it because it just came out today. Mm-hmm. But I have downloaded and started playing the last of the Guilda 1 games, Weapon de Omase, which is eShop 3DS game. Came out
by
today.
By level 5.
It is... So the basic... We talked about it on the show last week, but the basic premise is you are running a weapon rental service where you make weapons by playing a rhythm game that is essentially forging the weapon and then renting out appropriate weapons to RPG quest characters who then go out and engage in a quest. And if you are successful in arming them correctly, you will be paid a fraction of the rewards they reaped on their quest. It's, I'm going to call it a weird premise.
Yeah, that's not exactly how shops work in the RPGs I've played. Usually you pay for the weapons first and then, you know,
and
you
then
get
you
them.
never see that person again, probably.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, and in fact, they talk about that slightly. This is a very strange business plan. Which
it's almost as if it's contrived to let you interact as a follow-up with these people, and stay engaged in their quest without actually leaving your shop.
Yeah, it's almost as if it's an awful idea. So, I've only gotten through the first few opportunities to produce a weapon. They've had me produce a few different types of weapons. So I don't know a whole lot about the game just yet. The forging mechanic's pretty simple. You just tap out the rhythm that it tells you on the screen. You have to make sure not to tap the same place too many times. You'll damage the weapon. As you knock away the raw iron, the targets get smaller and smaller. You know, it's pretty basic stuff. It looks like as the game opens up, that gets more complicated. Picking out weapons for the adventurer based on their level and what kind of equipment they need for their quest looks like where the depth of this game is going to come in. But since I'm still really early, I can't tell. I'm going to go ahead and file it underway as an incredibly Japanese game. And we'll work from there. Because I don't know enough to put a good spin on how to, if it's worth buying yet, but it's definitely unique.
Dude, you got to bank your 10%.
That's true. I got to make my Skrilla.
Neil published his review today and gave the game a 5.5. He doesn't like the fact that there's a lot of, well, actually, like, he finds that there's not a whole lot of depth, actually. The heroes basically tell you the weapons that they need, and the game is mostly a collection of memes and jokes, and there's even, like, a Please Understand reference in the game, and the game has its own version of Twitter, and you can follow these heroes on Twitter, and there's some sort of podcast.
As they run their quest, yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It looks funny. I mean...
I'm thrilled that I get to give Iwata a sword.
Right.
Completely random.
I'm still working my way through the game. It's not very long, but it's a Guilda 1 game. They aren't, so I'm not surprised there's a depth issue. A lot of them were pretty simple games when it came to it. I'm fairly confident it'll cross the Aeroporter threshold, so I'm feeling much more confident about this purchase than the game where I bought a game where I had to sort luggage in a carousel. So we're feeling okay about this.
Keeping the bums out.
It's Yute Saito.
Yute Saito. You know,
from the genius of Seaman comes Aeroporter.
And Odama.
Yeah, Odama. Oh, geez.
Actually, yep. Odama was kind of amazing in its wackiness.
I forget about Odama every couple years and then...
You guys hated Odama? Really?
No, I like Odama, but it's weird.
Oh, I love that Odama exists.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's like...
Conceptually, I'm happier that it's a thing than I am when I'm playing it.
Actually, I loved it the first year they showed at E3 when you played it with the DK bongos.
Oof. And the microphone at the same time.
And the microphone, yes. There was actually a clip that you attached the Mario Party 5 microphone onto the DK bongos, and that's how you played the game.
That is an idea whose genesis could only happen outside the, you know, contiguous United States for right now.
Yeah.
Maybe Hawaii. Hawaii's a benefit there. I mean, come on, it's the pinball with microphone and bongos in feudal Japan with a warlord. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
And it's about the origins of the name of Nintendo or something like that. why don't we move on from Odama? And
you wanted sidetracks, and I would have to say that having Odama coming up in a podcast in 2014 is amazing.
That's how we roll. James, I know you played a lot more Bravely Default, and I know you've got somewhat mixed opinions on it. And I've heard it's weird. There's been kind of the backlash after the initial praise, and I think there's the backlash against the backlash where people are defending it as well.
I didn't even know there was backlash. I thought everybody loved it.
I mean, it's the more time you spend with it, the more nuanced things get. For me personally, I've actually spent a lot of time in Bravely Default, but it's been almost all managing the Street Pass mode this week because I haven't been able to sit down long enough to really play the game proper, except maybe just an hour or
two. You're still in the collection mode then?
Mostly, yeah. I'm still fairly early in the game, but James has plowed through very deep.
Yeah, the game takes a left turn at some point, and without can you, I don't know, without spoiling it, can you say anything?
So yeah, Bravely Default. I think last week I said I was somewhere at like 30-ish hours. I can't remember what number I threw out last time.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. So I am at about 42 at this point. So
man, you've been slacking.
Yeah, if you were to graph what's happened, you would notice, oh, that's a pretty precipitous drop in the rate. And the reason is, it's hard not to spoil, but there is a point in the game in which essentially the enemies in the game essentially are instantly made significantly harder, and it feels like the plot objectives have just been completely just pushed out of the way, and you're just being forced to grind for the sake of grinding.
Wow. And
that's bad.
It's not good. It's not a good feeling. It really sort of kills momentum on the game. And what I found when I went to Twitter and went, oh, this is awful, is everyone's like, yeah, you should pretty much just stop after the fourth chapter.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Which is right before this happens. So the way I got through it is I switched the game to easy mode so I could auto grind, put the auto grind on, which is essentially the game playing itself, and I just sat there and moved the circle pad with my thumb while I watched TV and let them find battles on their own.
That's always a sign of a great game.
It's sad. On the bright side, I gained
sad. It's such a good game.
I gained like 13 levels. So, you know, yeah. I watched a basketball game and the game played itself. It's pretty terrifying, but
maybe I will get through House of Cards this weekend.
There you go.
Hey-o.
It's disappointing. It feels completely unnecessary. I feel like even if they have some story conceit they wanted to get across, they could have accomplished it without doing all of this.
The weirdest thing to me is this is not even the first edition of this game. I mean, they've already gone and rebalanced a bunch of stuff once. Why didn't they fix this? Did they introduce this?
Oh, I hope not. I feel like it's such a – they would have to have rewritten a portion of the story at the very least. But ultimately, it does feel like this – I know why they had to make everything stronger, because by the end of the – what should be the end of the game, there's nothing left for you to run up against. Everything else is much, much weaker than you are. So they needed to give you a place to get stronger, but their decision to make that everywhere – seems somewhat unnecessary, and additionally, the decision to make the entire game sort of feel like you've gone backwards significantly. That's probably the closest I can get without spoiling it.
How fair would it be, though, to just say that this is a case of the game being just unapologetically old school? Because that's part of its charm, right? Is that it brings back these Final Fantasy classic memories that have really, you know, stretch that it really goes back into the Final Fantasy of pre-Final Fantasy VII.
To an extent, it would be. I think the extreme they took it to this time, I mean, I've played those games. I don't recall anything this dramatic of a just like, start over, have fun, kind of approach to the game. And it makes it very frustrating because at that point you have full access to the whole world and yet there's nowhere explicitly for you to go. They basically just said, do what you want to do for a while and then we'll come back to the story later.
This and kind also, of reminds me of Final Fantasy VI and the World of Ruin. I only played that game once years ago, but I seem to recall I checked a guide. Like, I was just following a guide because at that point in the game, there's much less direction. You've got this one character who's alone, and you have to find everyone else. And sure, you're near a town, so you're pretty sure that's where you're supposed to go first. But other than that, you're pretty much left on your own.
Yeah, that's when you have to put on the grown-up pants, because that game, it's very, very, very linear for the first half, and then when you get to the World of Ruin, it becomes very open world. You get a new airship in the World of Ruin almost right away, and as soon as you do, you can actually try to go beat the game with three characters, and I'm sure some crazy speedrunner has done it. But all the other characters are optional, and there are 14
characters. But isn't that what people want, as far as like having that open,
trust me,
world explore?
I love it. I mean,
you get the open.
I'm a massive fan of FF6.
Contrast that to getting the airship in 10, and all the airship in 10 does is let you bounce to different nodes. It's like, oh,
thank
now
you.
I can use my airship to go to that dot on the map.
Right.
All
yes.
right.
So this Preach. Game already opened up when it gave you an airship really early in the game. I mean, you can have it now.
It does, but there's a lot of places you can't go because the water is corrupted or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is nice that you can. It gives you the sense of, oh my gosh, they just cracked wide open, and it doesn't quite, but it's still really cool that you can do it.
But now you don't gain access to anywhere new. They've just sort of reshuffled the deck chairs, and you have to go through that whole process of I'm really weak all over again.
Well, that's a bummer.
It is. I really enjoyed the game up through, I guess they say it's chapter 4. I think I was with it till 5. But up until that, but now I'm just, I'm just trying to get through just so I can do it. Like, I'm hoping the game comes back to its senses at some point soon, but I don't know.
Do you have a sense for how late in the game this weird shift occurs?
I don't know. I don't know what's after this. I'm stuck.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, from what I've been reading, the chapters get progressively shorter.
They do.
Pretty common, actually, in this sort of game, right?
Yeah, like the first chapter is incredibly long. It's like 15, 20 hours. But chapter
you get to chapter two, you're like, what, chapters?
Yeah, you forgot,
you forgot this was a thing.
Chapter four, it's probably only, I think it's literally the time it takes you to clear one dungeon.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, they're real short. I don't even know if I'm in a chapter anymore. The game may have just completely given up on that nomenclature.
You've broken outside the box.
Yeah, It's a really hard thing to describe without spoiling what the game does, but at the same time, I kind of don't want people to experience it. Just be like, yeah, I wake up last crystal. I'm done. Everything's great now. We're good.
So why don't we move on to Guillaume? And you've been playing something that might seem – actually, I was surprised to hear that you were playing this, but I think I might understand why, and I think it'll tie into the show pretty well.
Yeah, well – there's many reasons why I've been playing the things I've been playing. First, there's not much coming out on Nintendo consoles right now, but also
until
I've been
tonight.
Accumulating a lot of, those AAA games that came out on other systems just through the PSN Plus subscription. And I've played a couple of them, but one that I actually liked and want to talk about is DMC, the reboot of Devil May Cry. And DMC... there's actually a good chance, I think, that Nintendo gamers don't really know what it's about or have never played it if they've never really, touched a Sony console. They might not even know what a character action game is, because what exactly did Nintendo get outside of what, Ninja Gaiden 3? That's the only one I can think of.
Well, Bayonetta 2.
Yeah, I mean, there's some stuff before that. There's a few Wii games. There's the weird Soul Calibur game, and there's
right, and
Rygar,
Dragon Blade. Yeah,
what about Beautiful Joe?
Beautiful Joe. Yeah, I was gonna say on GameCube,
sure.
There's a few things.
Yeah, no, Beautiful Joe, but it's a little bit different. It is a character action game, but it's not so combo based as the 3D games usually are. Devil May Cry. It's really. It's all about fighting enemies. It's all about mastering this combat system, this combo system. And there's some platforming in there. There's some exploration because they really want you to scour those levels and find doodads. But for the most part, what you're doing is trying to master these combos, chain up attacks in the most efficient way possible to get more and more points. To get more and more experience points, they call them, I don't know, souls or something, which you can invest in unlocking better combos, more powerful attacks. Yeah, it's all about just fighting demons all the time. So yeah, I've been playing that, and I've been enjoying it way more than I thought I would, because I've never played a Ninja Theory game before. This is the developer. I had played the demos for their other games, and nothing really jumped at me. Like, they all looked beautiful. It was a heavenly, not heavenly creature,
heavenly sword.
Yeah, and there was their Journey to the West game.
Enslaved. But,
Enslaved, thank you. But it seemed to be, like, Enslaved just seemed to be automatic platforming for the most part, just, like, the worst parts of Uncharted, in my opinion. But this...
Oh, man, the story in Enslaved was so good.
I love Enslaved. I think it's great.
Well, nothing really drew me in that demo. But again, like, I'm not judging the full games. I've never played it. But yeah, DMC surprised me because immediately the combat system felt good. And I think it also kind of won me over because the game is kind of easy. I was really expecting to struggle because I played maybe, I don't know, a couple of hours of the original PlayStation 2 game made by a completely, you know, by Capcom of Japan. Mm-hmm. And I remember just failing over and over again and dying
that game was
all
tough.
The time. Yeah.
And had some game, really tough bosses.
Right.
I'm kind of with you. I'm a huge Devil May Cry fan, but I am much more a fan of Kamiya's Dante than this Dante. And even though this DMC is by all rights a good game, I still sort of hold against it. It's not Devil May Cry-ness. Whereas I don't do that for Tomb Raider, which is weird because Tomb Raider, like the new Tomb Raider, just sort of for me stepped out and did its own thing. There's just something about DMC.
It did the thing that countless other big AAA games did. I wouldn't say it did its own thing. It did its Call of Duty thing, and it did its Batman thing, and but anyway, yeah.
Maybe by trying to be, but yeah. So Guillaume, you're right, and maybe by virtue of the way that it went, it stepped aside and did something different. I felt like this DMC was sort of straddling. Well, we're going to do a new modern DMC. We're going to use the Unreal Engine. We're going to take it, you know, sort of westerny. We got the new take on Dante, but at the same time, it's still going to be DMC. Right. Whereas the new Tomb Raider doesn't really try to be Tomb Raider. I mean when you're quote unquote tomb raiding are little one-off mini missions that you can complete in about 10 minutes, that's not Tomb Raider anymore.
Yeah. There's a couple of tombs, quote unquote. There's no tomb in there. There's no corpses, but and you have this one puzzle to solve in each of them, and you're basically done. But
and it's
a
good game in its own right too. But it's different. And DMC to me, DMC is like the action in DMC. I concur with you 100%. Very fun, very well put together. The back and forth with the different weapons, the way you have to use your different weapons to break different enemies. Smart. Really clever.
It's absolutely. It's easy to pick up. I like the fact that there is not that many combos. You don't have to remember a lot of things. You just have to know basically. Okay, so if I just mash a button, it's going to do something. It's going to do this combo, and you can switch weapons in mid combo. The combo will keep going. You can very easily chain attacks. You can really feel yourself getting better at the game as you play, and I really like that. It helps also that you're just unlocking very gradually these combos, so you have the time to learn them, you have the time to really familiarize yourself with them and what they do, and then they add something on top, and then they add something on top of that, you know. So basically, you're learning the game all the way throughout the single-player campaign. And once you finish a game, you can start over and keep your upgrades and basically unlock a new difficulty level where the enemies are remixed, and you can face right away in the first level. You can face enemies that were only in the last level. And at that point, you realize, okay, so I thought I was really good, but now I realize that I've been playing very sloppily, and it's time to get serious, and it's time to actually know what I'm doing at all times.
The God of War games are like that a lot, because if you play on the normal difficulty, you can more or less mash your way through. I mean, it takes some thoughtfulness, but it doesn't take a lot of skill or dexterity. And if you go back and play on the God mode or whatever it is on God of War, it's intense. You have to do a lot of blocking and a lot of dodging, and you have to be really careful about when you attack.
Right. And this one is all about juggling the enemies, sending them in the air and keeping them in the air because they can't really do anything to you while they're incapacitated, you know, like just up in the air waiting for you to jump at them and keep the combo going. And you've got different tools, like you can just basically shoot a whip at them and bring yourself to them in the air. Or you can, you know, an alternate attack is to bring them down to you and keep the combo going. You've got always tons of options at all times.
Well, that whole aerial locomotion thing becomes a big part of the game because you know, you being able to stay up in the air between enemies, that part's really, I don't deny it. Like the action in the game is really cool. The whole like psychedelic style that comes in when you're in limbo, that's really cool.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful game.
I think there's still room for, I just, you know, it's also, if you're someone who's been playing games for a long time, you have like these nostalgic sweet spots. And I definitely have a soft spot, I guess, a better way to put it. And I have like a nostalgic soft spot for Devil May Cry.
Yeah, I didn't get a PS2 until very late in its life. And I did try to go back to Devil May Cry, and it, you know, compared to God of War, it looked so pixelated, you know, like one of the very early games. And it was also confusing. The story didn't make any sense, and Dante gets, you know, stabbed with a sword and just, I could tell, okay, this is supposed to be badass, but I don't get it. So I didn't really stick with the game, and so I don't have that nostalgia for it. So I really enjoyed this game. But yeah, like this makes me actually really excited about Bayonetta 2, which is going to come out eventually, one day, who knows when, but one day on the Wii U. And even though, you know, I'm not expecting that the story is going to make a whole lot of sense just from what we've seen in the trailers. I'm expecting that how it plays is going to be at least on par with that. And it's probably, I don't know, like I had a good time. I played the demo at E3. I had a good time just smashing the buttons, but I realized that's not how you actually play those games. And I'm really looking forward now to spending more time with it, playing it correctly or learning to play it correctly. And I'm more excited now about these games, about this type of character action game.
You definitely have to play Ninja Gaiden.
First
one, I got a Ninja Gaiden Black and played it on the 360,
but that just game unforgiving. Is
that is right. A brutal game. I mean, I've played a lot of hard games, but geez.
It's not, though. It's unforgiving until you learn it, because it is the most it's the most amazing character action game for its ability to feel so brutal and awful until you really accept that, you know what? Just like any other just as I was going to try and play Street Fighter competitively, I'm going to have to learn how to play this game.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going to have to learn how to do the combos and when to use the combos and how to use each one of the different combos in what situations. And once you do, the game just like unfolds and opens up to you, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I actually got, I mean, a little bit into it. I played it for a few hours, and I was definitely really trying to learn to play Ninja Gaiden, and was like on GameFAQs reading tips, and it was like, okay, I really want to get something out of this. I don't want to just blast into it and just kind of flail my arms around. And I really enjoyed the sort of platforming and exploration. There's parts of that game that almost reminded me of like almost like a 3D platformer, in that there's secrets that are hidden in the environments that you have to do a lot of crazy wall jumping and flipping and stuff like that. I loved that stuff. But the combat was just so consistently, and I give a lot of props, I have a lot of respect for it, but it is so consistently challenging. Every single encounter that you run into is very deadly. And it got to a point where I think it wasn't even so much that any given encounter was that bad, but I would take a little bit of damage. And the problem is that over the course of two or three battles in a row where I wasn't getting any kind of health recharge or anything, there would be just a stretch where I could get almost to the end of this long series of battles, but I couldn't quite get to the end of it. And I tried it over and over and over again. And finally, I just got really frustrated with it, because I felt like I was, you know, obviously not playing well enough, but I felt like I was generally playing correctly. And was doing things the right way. Maybe I just hadn't practiced enough, but It was tough because I was really enjoying it up to that point, but it got to where there was something about the, I don't remember the details, but it was something about the checkpointing or the way that, you know, when you died and continued, it wouldn't start you with your full life bar or something like that.
It can no doubt be unforgiving, but it does.
Yeah. At some point, I felt like I kind of got pinned into a corner with that.
Greatly reward you learning the game.
Yeah. The thing is my only exposure to the newer Ninja Gaiden games is Razor's Edge on the Wii U. And I understand that, you know, it's the worst.
Yeah.
It's not the best regarded that's Ninja Gaiden game, but it really didn't make me, you know, want to explore the series further. Whereas DMC, I'm like, okay, you know what? Like, I'm really enjoying this. I kind of want to give the HD collection of PlayStation 2 games a chance, another chance. And I kind of want to try Bayonetta, even though, you know, the port on PlayStation 3 is supposed to be pretty awful. But I now crave more of these games, and I'm probably going to turn to those series before Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah. Well, Bayonetta 2 looks really amazing, and and you know, I played it last year at E3, and it's just not really my kind of game. For me, I'm more interested, like, I like character action games, but in a grander context. I'm more of like a Darksiders guy, where I'm interested in mastering that combat, but not going, you know, totally grognard on it. And for me, it's only rewarding in the larger context of having sort of free roaming exploration and building up my character and finding new equipment and stuff like that. So these games, I feel like, are really kind of a natural, very modern evolution of like a brawler, you know, like a Streets of Rage or a Final Fight. And those games are also about, you know, really learning those combos, learning the correct positioning of characters and everything. But there's something very repetitive about them. And I played the first Bayonetta, and I was like, you know, this is super crazy, and it sure is a whole lot to look at, but it just didn't grab me from a gameplay perspective. It was just, again, one of those things. I really respected what it was doing, but it didn't have enough personal appeal for me to play all the way through it.
Anyway, I am still psyched about it. You're not going to do this to me, Johnny Metz.
I'm not trying to down you on it, but I guess for me, it would be really exciting to see them come out and say something about Bayonetta 2 that made it sound significantly different and evolved somehow over the first one. And I don't think they're interested in doing that. I think, you know, Nintendo and Platinum both are primarily concerned about recapturing the fan base of the original and convincing them that this is the real deal and it's not being watered down for just because it's on a Nintendo system.
And now you can fight with a stylus.
Oh, that's true. That's real weird.
So I think there's a misstep there.
Yeah.
All right, so I will go next with new business. Played a couple of games on my PlayStation console, so please forgive me this brief jaunt. We do this quite often, actually, because we're all multi-platform gamers, and, you know, right now we're right before Donkey Kong comes out, and I'm not the world's biggest Donkey Kong fan, but I do plan on picking that up, and I expect I'll enjoy it a lot. I know Guillaume is over the moon about it, so we'll be talking a lot about that next week.
Two hours and 15 minutes before I download it.
Translation, hurry it up, Mets.
I know. Well, I did play something that Garnet's going to talk about next, but I figured I would drop a couple of comments on Strider, which just came out for PS4, and I think PS3 and PC also.
It's really clean looking. I saw it last night as well. I played some last night. I'm interested to see what you thought.
It was weird to me that there is a Strider game coming out now, considering that franchise really hasn't done much since. Was it a PS2 game?
There is a PS2 game. I don't know. I don't think it's very good.
I think arguably you'd go back to whether it's like, do you want the old Nintendo game or do you want the old arcade game?
Well, I want the Nintendo game. The one with the sort of Mega Man level structure where you pick where you're going and then you can revisit places later after you have new abilities. You can get into secret places. That's much more up my style. People compare it to Metroid, but I think it's actually maybe closer to Mega Man X, you know, where they're finite levels with a boss at the end, but you can replay them and you'll find different things every time because your character is getting new abilities. And I love both of those series anyway, but, so I'm a big fan of that one, not so much the arcade or the Genesis version. And the new Strider is definitely more, it's actually probably closer to a 2D Metroid or a Shadow Complex, because the entire game world is one contiguous thing. So there's one level in this game, as far as I can tell, and it's really big, and there's this big map that up in the corner of the screen that, you know, it auto maps just like in those other games. And, you know, I'm a total sucker for that stuff. So when I heard that that's what this game was going to be, and I already like Strider, I like the style of it. I like that it's fast paced and you're this ninja dude jumping around with a sword. Mm-hmm. One of the things I was just playing it before the show, and one of the things I noticed that I think really makes it feel, it really makes you feel like you're a ninja badass when you're playing the game, is just the fact that Strider, when he's running, if you hit the attack button, he swings the sword, but he doesn't even slow down.
Yeah.
He just keeps on running. And the same thing when you're jumping. So if you really just want to truck it through the game, just left to right, there's really nothing to stop you. It's just really, really fast paced. And yet, because the levels are nonlinear and you can go up and down and you can climb on the walls, and there are a lot of, you know, locked doors and places where you need the slide kick to go through and stuff like that, It slows you down that way, but it feels more like, when you're towards the end of a Castlevania game, like a 2D Castlevania game on GBA or DS, where you've gotten all the upgrades that make you go a little bit faster and jump a little bit higher. And just generally you can play the game at a much quicker pace. That's how Strider feels right off the bat, even before you get any of the upgrades. And I think there are quite a few abilities to unlock. So I have not played it very much, maybe an hour, which is not nearly enough, but I've been really busy this week, and I'm super pumped to play more of it. It does look really nice. It runs incredibly smoothly on the PS4. And it's like, I feel like this is the kind of just like really, you know, down to the bone action game that I don't currently have on the PS4. It's just something really fun and easy to pick up and play on that system that I haven't had up to this point. Most of the games I've been playing are things like Knack or Assassin's Creed 4. They're more sort of, you know, more grandiose things that you kind of need to get into and spend more time with. And Strider is just so fast paced. And you can zip from one save point to the next in the span of a couple of minutes. So you can play it in very small chunks if you want to. But I really like it. And I, you know, I haven't played enough of it to say much more than that, but I'm very happy about it so far.
It has a really super clean look to the visuals on it. Jeff and I were looking at it. I was over at Kanata's place last night. We were playing, doing board game night. That's where we sat down and played it. And I was like, man, you know, I like what they did with it, but it's almost so clean. It feels like too clean for a retro reboot. I don't know if that's possible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, well, like,
if you're comparing it to something like Bionic Commando Rearmed.
Yeah.
Like that game has such a weird kind of almost World War II or Vietnam era, like military grittiness to it. And I think they carried that over really well in that sort of remake, or, you know, semi sequel or whatever you want to call it. Whereas Strider, it feels like everything that looked like it was made of metal in the original game, which was all, I mean, most of the enemies you're fighting are robots. You slice them in half. You know, it's like it feels like the everything except Strider is made of shiny metal.
That's maybe it. Yeah, right?
So it's very clean.
And the background is light blue. It's very pastel, mm-hmm. almost.
Yeah.
And you've got super awesome air control, which was always a big part of Strider, and like the ability to slash wherever you want to while you're in the air. So, I mean, it's really, really frantic, but it moves really well.
It does.
Yeah, I played the demo. Good. It felt, you know, yeah, it was easy to feel like I was a ninja badass, but how do you not take damage in that game? That's what I haven't figured out.
I think there's a couple things. First off, I've actually heard people complain about this, that the shot patterns of the enemies and the way the enemies are arranged and the way that they attack you isn't tight enough for you to really completely avoid damage. So there's just like a certain amount of damage that you're gonna take. And you just need, you know, as you kill enemies, you'll get little pickups that refill your health. So I think the idea is that you just kind of blast through.
I mean, that was sort of the way with the old Strider arcade game, though. It wasn't so much avoiding all damage. It was economizing what damage you have to take and avoiding the ones you don't have to hit.
And that's pretty much the game here.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about like that mixed with the, you know, a total, it, obviously another game to reference, it looks like Shadow Complex a lot.
Yeah, yeah. It's not nearly as deliberate as Shadow Complex.
Oh no, the combat system I'd say is way, you know, like not way, but it's like a step forward. Obviously, it's much later. It's, you know, had a lot of learning go on since then.
Yeah, and it's a melee-based game, so it just feels more direct and confrontational and a lot faster-paced. Man, Shadow Complex, what are those guys doing? That game is so amazing. I just think it's a damn shame that they would drop something that brilliant and then walk away from it.
You just drop the mic and walk off. Bam.
Yeah. I think Infinity Blade is okay, but we sure didn't need four of those. The other game that I played this week, actually started and completed in 2 days, is called Rain. And, Garnet, was this something you played last year on PS3?
I played the demo and have checked it out and thought it looked beautiful. And sadly, I must say that I did not get to it and am humiliated at not that, because I'm sure you're about to say it's awesome and amazing and overlooked, because everyone has, and it makes me want to play it because it looks pretty.
I think hardly anybody played it, so you're not the only one. But yeah, it's I picked it up on the – it had a sale recently. I think I got it for like $5 or something like that, and it is really a wonderful game. I mean, I would put it up there with something like Journey, because it's 2 or 3 hours long. It's, you know, not a lot of like really deep, complex gameplay or anything. A lot of it is just sort of moving through the narrative, and you engage with – It's a little more structured than Journey is, but not that much. And it's not super difficult or anything like that. It's the goal of the game is to get to the end, and they try pretty hard to make sure that you do. And it tells this really beautiful kind of story without really telling you a story. I mean, there's some text that pops up in the environment it's really nicely done, but it's not overly explicit. It doesn't tell you what all this means. And, you know, I think it's just a really interesting idea. I was thinking, like, it's almost like something that like Peter Molyneux would write on Twitter. You know, it's like, what if there was a stealth game where you
the
and the enemies.
Fake Peter Molyneux or the real one?
No, the fake one, Peter Molyneux. Yes. It's like a stealth action game in which both you and the enemies are invisible.
That actually has been written.
Like, how do you even make that work? You know, it's like, you can't see your own character, which is already a really interesting game mechanic, because you're controlling something in a 3D environment, but you can't always actually see what you're doing. So a lot of it is based on recency. So you could see yourself a few seconds before, and you know that you just have to get over this short stretch of floor before you get to the next place where you can see yourself. And in between, you can't see yourself at all. So you just kind of have to remember where you were going or the direction that you were heading, and try to manage it that way. And then with the enemies, their detection of you, it's a stealth game, like I said, but their detection of you is almost purely visual. Like making sounds, tramping around in water, it rarely comes into play. Most of the time they can only detect you if they see you directly in their line of sight. But you're invisible. So it's really, if they see you, it's your fault because you didn't hide under cover or something like that. But at the same time, they are also invisible, and they will be on paths moving back and forth in and out of cover. And so sometimes you have to sort of just discern where they must be based on their pattern and the speed of movement and whatever. And so you kind of just have to kind of intuit where they are right now versus where you are. And there are times when you're moving around these environments trying to stay away from these enemies where you can't see either your character or the enemy at any given moment. But you're both moving and you're both kind of heading towards a certain direction, and you're just hoping that you stay far enough away from it that you can kind of sneak by before either of you becomes visible again. It's so interesting. I've never played a game where you do this kind of stuff before. It's not like the best playing game ever, but I think it has a really interesting idea and it does a lot of cool things with it. But my favorite thing about this game is the sound design.
Mm.
Over the weekend, I bought a 5.1 soundbar, which is like hardly an audiophile piece of gear, right?
You know, I'm kind of like an amateur audiophile, so I'm going to snicker now.
No, I understand, but this is why I wanted to talk about it, because I knew you were going to be on the show. So for me, it's like I have been playing games out of my flat screen TV speakers, which is clearly not good, right? And I know it's not good. But I'm very intimidated by buying a huge 7.1 thing. You know, I don't want to have to buy a receiver because I don't know what that does or how to hook it up or have all the right cables. I've never owned one. I've never really used one. So that all just seems like extreme overkill to me. So I love the idea of a soundbar where it has a lot of bells and whistles, and it's a huge upgrade over what your TV does, but it's very self-contained. It's very easy to install, and it's low profile, so I don't have to like completely rearrange my entire apartment to get it in there. But it also comes with a subwoofer, and this one also comes with two wireless satellite speakers to put in the back of the room that just connect to the subwoofer.
Of course, and it comes with a subwoofer. Everybody just wants to hear a thump.
Yeah. Well, I actually turned the bass way down because I don't want to disturb my neighbors either. But the satellite speakers, the ones that go in the back of the room, make a huge difference. And it's been so long since I played a game with surround sound that I had actually forgotten how awesome it is and what a huge difference it makes. And playing a game like Rain was so ideal, and I didn't plan it that way. It just happened that I turned that game on the same day that I bought this this new speaker system. And the great thing about Rain is that the entire game is set in this city where it's raining for the entire game, and it's raining heavily. So you've got this kind of very heavy pitter-patter of rain in the background. And when you have the surround sound speakers and you have one near your head, you're getting the sound of the rain coming from in front of you and from behind you at the same time. And it's not intermittent because it's this steady drone of rain. It really does feel like it's all around you all the time. It's just following you around. And it is so simultaneously relaxing, but also a little bit scary, because the game, it kind of plays with like being a little bit creepy or a little bit scary every now and then. And the rain covers up the other sound effects to the point where sometimes you can't tell whether you just heard something or not. And it puts you on edge just a little bit. So you're like, wait, did I just hear an enemy over there? Because you can't see him. He's invisible, right? So it introduces just enough doubt and uncertainty into what's happening around you. And yet at the same time, that sound of rain is so hypnotizing and incredibly relaxing that it was really kind of a magical experience to just lay down on the couch with the speaker right next to my head and this, you know, and all the music. And the music, by the way, is gorgeous as well. This amazing piano score, coming out of the front speakers. But I thought it was just overall just a really, really wonderful experience. And, I'm so very happy that I played through it.
Instead of buying an expensive, soundbar or sound system, I'm just going to stick with my Homedics radio clock with six nature sounds. Oh, no. I've got some tropical rain there. I think I'll be fine.
Cynic.
That's too bad. Now, it really is astonishing the difference that that having surround sound makes. And I think Sony has a reputation for, you know, having really excellent implementation of surround sound in their games. But
yes, they do. PS3, first one, keep in mind, PlayStation supports DTS audio, so as opposed to Dolby, which, you know, a lot of theater files prefer the DTS for the way it handles the low-frequency channels. Hmm. It's a little less muddy, it's a little more musical, it definitely pulls out the sounds versus the special effects better. You know, I find a lot of times even in... well, of course, it all comes down to how well the audio engineer puts the mix together as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors that come into it. But DTS, right, to me, is really... is the top tier.
Yeah, I don't know if I could tell the difference or not between those things, but I can definitely tell the difference between using my TV audio and having actual speakers.
Sure, of course.
And it's actually really dramatic. And that's kind of what I wanted to convey, is that even as a Philistine who really knows absolutely nothing about audio, I mean, I bought this thing at Costco. You know, I did.
It doesn't matter where you bought it. I mean, look, the thing about audio bars that is cool is, I mean, they're taking advantage of the idea of reflected sound, right? So,
yeah.
So they're bouncing the sound waves through your environment. So depending on what sort of shape and space you're in, your results may vary on how well the projected sound field works. Sort of similar to Bose, all the theories that Bose have always espoused. And my retort to this is that, yeah, if you want a big boomy bass experience, which no matter how much you turn down that sub, you're still going to get a big thump from it, and no mids and like a crazy experience, yeah, it's definitely better than the speakers that came in your cabinet of your TV, especially in the era of flat screens where you know, there's no room for a driver. But there's nothing that compares to having real loudspeakers in your listening environment. And if you think you got a step from your television to your soundbar, the step from a soundbar to a, you know, multi-loudspeaker driven off of a home theater receiver system, mm-hmm, is is factors of magnitude larger.
I can imagine. One day, maybe if I own a house.
But you see, also, if you had a receiver, typically receivers have what they'll often call like a night mode that allows you to basically have the receiver internally adjust the sound profile to cut a lot of the low frequency, as if you were listening to it late at night and didn't want to have all that boom.
Nice. All right. Well, speaking of subs, darn it.
Oh, God. Wow.
I've been playing that coming. For minutes on end.
Great.
You wanna dive into the waters?
Yeah. Let's get wet.
Okay. Hey, remember that awesome game that came out with the 3DS called Steel Diver? That game was good, wasn't it?
System seller.
It's pretty much the reason we got the ambassador program, I think.
It was the best.
Killer app.
So, hey, you know what? Let's make a sequel to it.
Yeah. The world
is
crazy.
And here's the funny thing. The sequel is actually awesome. How bizarre is that?
What? Okay, but awesome in a I did not expect this on the 3DS eShop kind of way, or awesome in terms of I will actually keep playing this for more than 3 hours.
For multiplayer, I'll totally play it. So we're talking about Steel Diver Subwars, which just came out on the eShop, and it's also one of the first Nintendo free-to-play entries, which is interesting. They clearly are, you know, taking baby steps trying to figure out how to make free-to-play work, because the way this model works is that you get two subs for multiplayer, and multiplayer is wide open, so you can play, you know, with anybody. You can play when you go in to start a game, you can play worldwide or within your region. There are a number of other subs that you get if you buy the unlock. It's a $10 unlock. So it's free to play and there's a $10 unlock. There's no microtransactions. Well, there are microtransactions coming evidently, but right now it's a $10 unlock that gives you a bunch of extra subs for multiplayer. But having fought against folks who have those, I don't feel outgunned. I read up ahead of time and
oh, I did.
Did you really? Because they're all balanced. They're balanced pretty
well. Yeah, I felt very outgunned. And it could also be that I hadn't played enough and I didn't really know what I was doing, but
maybe you're just terrible.
Yeah, quite possible.
Yeah. Well, Johnny, this is definitely a whole other sort of game than what you'd expect. And that to me is the really fun part of it is this driving a sub around and in a multiplayer environment has always sort of had like that cool sort of allure to it, but no one has made it. And every time they try to do it on the PC, there's this immediate slide down the cliff into, well, we're going to make it technical, right?
Yeah, it turns into Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Right, and there's definitely a market for that, and people were down with that, and that's cool. But this is just like this perfect little experience of driving my sub around underwater, looking for enemies, and then once you get into a fight with them, it becomes this weird slow maneuvering, trying to get a tactical advantage sort of dance, and hoping that one of the other members of their team doesn't see you, because a two-on-one situation in this game is really deadly. Really, yeah. Really deadly. But you've got dumb torpedoes, and you've got lock-on torpedoes. There's very cool element of leading your shots to it. I mean, that's probably one of the most fun parts to me is, you know, you get a lot of stalking, and then finding your shot and lining it up, and because it incorporates that delay to reload your torpedo tubes, you do actually think a little bit. But I mean, you don't just like, oh, I got a guy in my crosshairs, bam, because you know that once you fire, A, it's going to give away your location, and B, it's going to take you a moment to reload. So, you know, when you lose a torpedo, you want to make it count because you've exposed yourself and you're going to be a little wet before you hit. It's
right.
Unfortunate.
And there are so many ways that they can avoid the torpedo too, because the torpedoes are slow and the sub can go up and down and left and right. And if it turns towards you, it becomes like this. Well, you know, there's much less of an area to hit.
Right. Yep. You reduce your profile and it becomes a lot harder to, there's a lot more room for error if the sub is pointing directly at you.
Yeah.
You get that whole like Hunt for Red October where like people turn right into the torpedo and then basically try to dodge it.
Mm-hmm.
which works great if it's a dumb torpedo, but if it's a homing torpedo, keep in mind that that's going to be still pretty challenging because it's going to try and home in on them.
Yeah, which I think then you could try to counter it with your own torpedo if you get it off in time.
Right, and you have, of course, you have like this weird, the one thing that's kind of weird is you have like this stealth mode with bubbles, which totally makes no sense at all. You start off with a full air tank and you press this button and it releases bubbles and you disappear. You visually disappear from the opponent's screen. You'll be trailing someone and they'll just disappear and you know, oh, they pressed the bubbles button.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you run out of air, so you surface and it refills your bubbles and then you can go back down underwater and you have bubbles again. But the thing that you have to remember is that you don't actually disappear. So if you have a torpedo coming at you and you hit the bubbles, you still have to maneuver because it will still hit you through the bubbles. It's not like a shield. It's just a it's just a weird visual effect that helps you disappear from people's scans. I just think it's a really well put together game. It's a really put together light, fun experience. I like how like this is one case where I actually when I'm sitting on the couch playing it, you can use the periscope to look around. And I've read some people who are complaining like, oh, you know, when I use the periscope and look around with the stick, it's hard to get it recentered. This is one of those cases where the gyroscope works great. Like you put the periscope up and I've actually like stood up as if I was on board some stupid sub and like panned around and be like, oh, look, they're there. Because then when I come back out of periscope mode, I'm still like view screen pointed straight ahead and I don't have to reorient myself. Mm. And so it sort of works.
That makes sense, actually.
It totally works.
One thing I found that was frustrating for me, and I wasn't using the periscope. Maybe I need to go back and try that, because I found that it was difficult to figure out what the subs around me were doing, because you have a sonar and it'll show the blips on your radar of where other people are located, but it doesn't show you which way they're pointing or which way they're traveling.
Oh, yeah,
or
dude,
what
you gotta,
they're doing.
You gotta be on your periscope.
Yeah, there's a certain, you need more situational awareness than you're gonna have just from looking forward in the standard view.
Oh, definitely. Don't overping either, because keep in mind, every time you ping, that also puts your dot on their radar, on their sonar.
Oh, good point.
Because you're sending out an active sonar. So, like, one of the things that a lot of folks are doing early on in the game is going deep and using bubbles and waiting for other folks to show up on screen. The other thing is that you start off in random spots, so it's really important to find your teammates early on, because if you are by yourself in this game, you are at a distinct disadvantage until you find one of your teammates. Or if they find you, you know, if the enemy finds you and they've teamed up, you're going to be in a tough spot.
That's what happened to me.
Yeah, that's going to be almost always a lose. If you're by yourself, haven't hooked up with any of your teammates, and you get caught by a pair, or worse yet, three or four, you're going to be in trouble, because what's going to happen is one of them is going to hunt you directly and cause you to maneuver, and the other is going to swing out and catch you while you have to come across them.
So there's no way to play this game against friends, right? It's only regional or...
Yeah.
Not that I saw in the menu.
That's a bit of a bummer.
And there's single player, and you know, here's the thing is I'm not actually interested, like, the single player, you get training, and then like a hunt the convoy mission. And the single player, I think, still has the same sort of snores to it that the first original game. It's like, okay, it's sort of fun, but, you know, it's not Star Fox. It's not...
No.
Yeah, right? But then the multiplayer sort of is a weird, slow-speed Star Fox 4-on-4. It's very... I'm unbelievably impressed by this game being a Nintendo game, that it's on the 3DS, that it has me outplaying my 3DS. I wish they had done the free to play differently, because I don't really want to drop $10 on the extra subs, because I don't really care about the single player content. But I guarantee you, this is a game where if the subs were 99 cents or $4.99 for a pack of them or something, I'd already have bought them.
Well, maybe they will listen to you. I mean,
yeah, they're testing different ways to sell their games. They've been trying crazy experiments lately.
But the best part about this experiment is, look, if you have a 3DS, there's absolutely no reason not to go grab this right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you should at least try it. Absolutely,
and play it online. Don't be intimidated. It's
all,
really
but...
fun online. This is not like Call of Duty or Titanfall, where it's like instantaneous. You've got to have like amazing Twitch skills to play the game. this is the beauty of it is that they simplified all the sub controls and brought it to just the tactical nature of piloting a sub underwater. There's momentum. I mean, granted, it's exaggerated. You can take your sub and from full speed ahead, slam it in reverse and slow down pretty quick and do a pivot. Okay. So they made some accommodations for it being a game. I think that improves the game nature of it, but you still have it's still a much slower pace than anything you've played in first person perspective. Slower pace.
It's very slow.
Contemplate a first person shooter. Yes.
I played some online and it didn't really grab me, but you know, clearly I didn't really fully grasp what was going on. I didn't do the training, so maybe I need to go back and go through that.
Dude, go do the training.
Get a better feel for what's going on there. But I'm surprised that you like it so much, and I'm very encouraged to go back and give it another chance.
It's fun. It's just plain simple fun. You can sit down. It's perfect for the handheld too. It's like sit down, flip it open, hop in a game. Has not taken me long to get a match made game going. Games last 5 minutes, and then it's like, oh, okay, I'll get up and go do something different now, or I'll play another one if I'm like, oh, that game went well. Oh, I want to play again, or oh, wow, that game did not go well. I don't want to play another one right now, or I want revenge.
Well, I think the 3DS definitely is lacking for online multiplayer games, and I hadn't thought about this until just now, but there's a lot to be said for Nintendo giving this one out to everyone.
Yep.
So they should never have problems with not enough people playing it, because everybody has access to this and can play the online mode version as much as they want. And, you know, I wish it had something more like voice chat, but without friend matching, maybe that wouldn't make too much sense. But I think the Morse code thing is really interesting. It's cute, but it's also, I could see people like using that to get away with some pretty crazy like online conversations, you know, stuff that Nintendo normally would not allow.
To explain what you're talking about, the only way to chat inside the game to your fellow submariners is using Morse code, like submariners of the World War II era did.
It's the weirdest stuff ever.
And what happens is when you open up the chat window, the entire Morse code alphabet is shown underneath the chat box. So, and that's dots and dashes, dots for the small, for the short tap, and dash for the long tap. And you use the Y button to tap out your Morse code. And once you're done, so you're in essence, you know, spelling out what you want to type in chat, but you have to do it all in dots and dashes. Mm-hmm. And then once you're ready, you click send, and it sends it to the other person who gets it in dots and dashes, gets, you know, dee 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 dee, and then spells it out on the screen, and you're chatting with each other. And it is surreal. It is completely surreal. It's really hard to do, of course, in the context of fighting and battle, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah. It'd be awesome if you could have like a local team, more like a space team, you know, where you had one person driving and one person manning the torpedoes and another person doing all the Morse code communication. And you could, maybe for the next Steel Diver, they'll put together some kind of team.
A little bit like that. Yeah, so, but you're adding complexity back in.
Well, yeah. I mean, that would be an optional
thing. Saying, you're adding the complexity back in.
It'd be like in Mario Kart Double Dash, where you can team up and do co-op, where one person drives, the other person just does the weapons, you know? The weapons and the sliding. Mm. Well, that's a nice surprise. So I'm glad you played more of that than I did, and I feel ashamed.
And you've been out Nintendo'd.
Yes. I'm glad. I'm very happy about it. So let's wrap up.
By the guy without a Wii U.
Yeah, well, there's nothing to play on it anyway, right? No, there is. We will talk much more about Wii U next week, I'm sure. But for now, let's wrap up this segment. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to do a little more chatting with Garnet and ask him some questions from Twitter and Gaff and maybe some emails as well from our own listeners. So we'll see you back in just a few minutes.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze by Andy and Dunn. It will take two reviews to cover the Big Ape's latest platformer. With much better proximity to banana farms, come see if their freshness makes swinging for nanners in North America better than it is in Europe. And we have a feature, digital games versus retail games, The Face-Off by Andy Gergen and Tom Molina. Andy hates nostalgia, permanence, owning his own property, memories, and non-astral states of being.
That's why he paints 8-bit canvas portraits.
Yep, he hates it.
Tom is a good person. Who is right? You decide. It's Tom.
Fair and balanced, James. Oh, that sounds like a great debate. And I wonder what they really say. All right, so next up we have a review for Spot the Differences! Exclamation point on the 3DS by Don Koopman, who writes 75% of the reviews on our website. DSiWare was a collective of greatness. Between the flashlight apps, the strobe light apps, the fake fireplaces on the go, farm games, and even pets games with a Z, there was the true gold, Spot the Differences. All edge of your seat action right in the palm of your hands. Two images, two eyes, two dimensions, 10 differences. Except now, it's in three dimensions. Game does not appear to support three dimensions.
An important disclaimer.
Oh, boy. We also have a feature called Nintendo's Third Pillar, How Nintendo Plans to Improve Your Quality of Life, by James. Over 6,000 words later, James is finally ready to make his less-than-bold predictions about what the quality of life platform is. He's wrong, but damn it, he tried. And on a personal note, this part was not written by James.
Nope.
It's an awesome article, and you guys should really go check it out. It's a great piece of writing and super interesting. Great stuff.
Thank you. Now I'm going to destroy the rest of the sites. Hold on. We have a feature, okay. Australia Pokemon DVD Contest Winners by Andrew Brown. We heard from you, our Aussie readers, and we got lots of great submissions to win a Pokemon DVD. Included here are the five best. Way to rep, Southern Hemisphere. We also have an editorial, Sumo Sultan, The Quest for the Perfect Gaming Chair by Justin Baker. Justin sits his ass down in a giant bag full of foam beams. For you! We here at NWR risk life and limb, and Justin did so just to tell you if it's safe to return to a time in your parents' basement.
Beanbags best enjoyed with a bag full of gamer grub.
Oh, God.
All right. Well, you can check out all of this original content and lots more over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It is the second half of our special episode with Garnet Lee here, and I put out a call today on Twitter and our NeoGAF thread about Garnet being on here, and said, "Hey, if anybody has any questions, let me know." My tweets got retweeted a lot, but very few people actually sent questions. I don't know what's up with that. But I know one thing that people wanted to hear about. This comes from Jason, was asking why Weekend Confirmed got shut down. I know you've kind of covered it on there, Garnet, but I thought maybe you could just give the very quick version of it, because you're coming to us now. You're, you know, sort of between career spots right now.
In other words, you mean I don't have a job, which is accurate. Yeah, I don't have a job.
Fun employment, whatever you want to call it.
I actually have a quick comment about that. Fun employment is such a weird notion, because I've heard people like bat it around, and now that I'm like unemployed, my thought on fun employment is this. There's definitely different kinds of people in the world, and I'm clearly one of those whatever type A personalities, because it's driving me nuts already. But I kind of wonder if, you know, the origin of fun employment wasn't in people trying to help themselves make light of the situation, in which case I think it's a really good idea. Like, it's a really good idea it's really important to not get into a negative mindset about it, but make no mistake, it's really not fun. Or at least
it's
I don't
pretty
think
stressful,
fun.
I thought.
It is pretty stressful.
The last time I went through. Yeah.
It is pretty stressful. So anyway.
Vibes, man. Good vibes.
Oh, thanks. And you know, I mean, I've gotten so much love from everybody out there, which I massively, massively appreciate. So
and
that's
which
awesome.
You deserve.
The thing with Weekend Confirmed was was pretty straightforward, actually. Look, I mean, we had a great run with Gamefly. They were an excellent place to work at. Worked out to be a really good thing with what we were able to do building up Shack News. It's just that the company decided to make some strategic decisions and do different stuff. They're focusing on their rental business. They've divested themselves of Shack. They sold Shack right before the end of the year. You know, and Andrew's moving on with their, they've picked up some stuff, you know, and getting out seems to be really good for Shack. And Weekend Confirmed was an editorial property that was built while I was there at Shack. So I didn't, you know, it wasn't mine. I didn't own it independently. Mm-hmm. There was some options out there as far as what might be able to do, like an agreement as far as like having the name or whatever. But in the end, it's easier. It just feels like the right thing to do to say, you know what, that was Weekend Confirmed. We're gonna close that chapter and start something new, because in all actuality. Even, you know, I was talking to Jeff yesterday about what, you know, we want to do next. It's probably going to be different again, you know. You know, there was something from the One Up Yours to Listen Up to Weekend Confirmed. It's always been this sort of studio show with four people. You know, four people has always been a constant to all of it. And I'm kind of ready to maybe mix it up and do something different. Jeff and I are talking about maybe doing, like, you know, a show that's just the two of us, more casually, like hanging out, drinking beer, talking about games. There's definitely been a lot of call from people to have us do more video stuff. And it just seems like the right time to say, you know what, there are a multitude of shows that have done or do this, you know, 3-4 host video game podcast show, and I want to do something different. So I want to do something cool. I want to do something different. I want to have a good time with it. And so I'm going to try and make that happen.
Well, best of luck, man. You know, I'm going to be listening to whatever you do.
And it won't be Weekend Confirmed. So, and you know, right. It's good. It's good. Like, Weekend Confirmed had a great run. It was awesome. We had a great time with it. And I will look back on it every bit as fondly as I looked back on, you know, well, maybe not every bit as fondly, because Listen Up and One Up Yours, like, it was a special time at One Up. Those groups and teams were special. But I could tell you that, you know, what Jeff and I have done with Weekend Confirmed was really special to us, you know, from starting off with Leahy there to having Zav working with us to developing the relationship with Christian, having Andrea there as a regular. I mean, there's just been a lot of great relationships and conversations and energy around that show as well. And you know what? It came to an end, and it's a bummer. Something new will happen. It's sort of like, don't get so upset about, you know, things coming to an end. It's you know, it's sad, it's a bummer, but don't worry. Something new will be born from the ashes, and like a phoenix, rise and cut a fiery path across the night sky.
That's a great attitude. you probably don't remember this, Garner. The first time I met you was at E3, and it was the year that you guys did a live version of Listen Up on the show floor, and Billy was going to be on it, and I found out about this, and I was working the show for our site, but I told the guys, hey, don't book me anything during this time slot, and I was in the front row for the whole thing. And I was taking bunches of pictures, and I was so excited. And it was really weird and really awesome to get to see that show made like 10 feet away from me.
The, you know? Was that the year we did it on the G4 stage?
Yeah.
That was really cool of G4, by the way. They were really awesome to let us do the show on that stage. That was really fun.
And it was like a full 2-hour podcast.
Yeah, we did the full
show
there.
On the floor of E3, during E3. It was really
crazy. The real E3 nightmare was like like 3 or 4 years before that, we had it at One Up, we had this booth, and the booth had what we called the fishbowl, which someone in their wisdom had come up with this idea that it would be really, you know, a lot of the editorial outlets, all of them basically, have their editorial teams on the show floor working, which is both because it's a strategic location to get in and out and, you know, easy to get to the booths and so forth, but also to sort of, you know, put a public-facing forward so that developers walk by. You can easy to get developers in and have them do interviews, and it sort of also does a little publicity for your site, right? So we had this site, we had this set up at 1UP, and it was called the Fishbowl, and it was this like acrylic glassed-in workroom that was raised about 5 feet off the ground. And
it's like and a nightmare.
It was nutty. It was really nutty because the booth also had like this upstairs section with like a stairway that was sort of like a stairway out of a London double-decker bus that walked that like did like a snaky spiral, and then there was like a patio thing up on top. And but you're in the middle of E3 where it's like super loud and it's crazy, and of course the enclosed plexiglass workroom, which was also the studio we were using to record the podcast, had like one tiny little air vent that had like a duct coming from who knows where that sort of wheezed a little semi-cool air into it. So it really was more like a terrarium as we sat in there in sweat. And oh man, it was amazing, really weird experience. And Pfister was awesome running the gear and trying to keep us all like sane as we're like sitting in there sweating and dealing with security, who was like wanting to give us hell because we wanted to record the podcast after hours, right? But then they're like, you can't stay in here, you can't stay in the hall after hours. And we're like, well, we're exhibitors, of course we can stay. And then there was like this big back and forth, of course. And yeah, it was always a nightmare. Oh. But yeah, that was a thing.
So getting off the floor at your work is salvation. I can't imagine being on the floor the whole day. Like, I'm ready to get off the floor pretty much as soon as I get on at this point.
We wised up a few years later and actually got a work room that was up in the meeting hall areas that was way, way, way better because you actually got away from the hall and could imagine this, get your work done.
That's a nice area up there. The other thing I wanted to say, it was kind of funny to me, you talking about trying to get away from this thing where it's like four guys sitting in a studio. The only time I've ever had that experience was when I got to be on Weekend Confirmed after E3 last year, which was like, seriously, and I'm not bullshitting you, like one of the coolest things I've ever done in my entire life. And I told
the studio was rad.
Oh man, that the Atlantis group, like I would love to go do a show there sometime. Just I don't know how to make that happen, but I would love to. But for me, it was, you know, really, really awesome to get to be on the show with you guys and get to talk about stuff with you guys and get to meet Jeff and John and, you know, all those other guys who were on the show that day.
It was fun. But it was definitely fun.
The weirdest thing for me was just the environment. It was being in the studio because I've been podcasting for, you know, years and years and years and years, and I've never had seen anything like that. And it was such a crazy experience.
It was weird for me too. So, I mean, you know, at 1UP, we did not have a relationship with an outside studio. I mean, part of the thing of being in LA is that there are tons of recording studios. And so people, you know, a lot of times people would ask, well, why do you spend all this money to do the show in a fancy studio? Well, in reality, it wasn't that much money relative to, you know, like at the time, of course, since we were all working for Gamefly and Gamefly was our primary sponsor, then you have to think that, okay, for us as employees, it worked out pretty well to have the studio because we go to the studio and everything's set up for us. Everything is run for us, and they engineer the sound. So there's no post production. Like we go in, sit down, record the show, and at the end of the show, they hand you Dave would plug in his drive and download the like bounced down MP3 ready to upload. Boom, we're done.
Yeah, imagine how jealous Guillaume felt when I told him about that.
I don't have to imagine. Like for the many years that I did for the many years I did 1UP Ears and Listen Up, I did exactly what you guys did. I mean, I sat there and like engineered it. I ran the board. I listened to the monitor. And once it was done, I was like going in and fixing the levels and doing all the cuts in and out. And like, yeah, so I know. I feel that pain.
Yeah. It's time intensive.
Yeah, it's super time intensive, but you know, so having a professional engineering team to do that, and you know, for a couple $300 a session was great. But you know, for me now, like trying to think about doing it independently, trying to come up with a few hundred dollars per session in order to run the show, that's actually a whole other, you know, that's really difficult, especially considering that I have no income now. So, you know,
that is a problem.
It would be awesome. It'd be awesome as I'm trying to figure out how to do these shows, if I could figure out, you know, part of what I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do in the future is, you know, am I going to be able to do this? Can I do media like this? Is there a way to do it independently and cobble together a living, or am I going to wind up taking a job? And the reality is I'm probably going to wind up having to take a job, but, you know, in the meantime, we'll see what happens. I might run a Patreon if I, you know, once we get some stuff running, might run a Patreon. So we'll see how it goes. I can eat ramen for a little while.
Yeah, I've actually talked to these guys about maybe trying to for our 400th episode coming up in the fall, maybe trying to rent out a studio around here. If we can get the travel put together, if we can get everybody out in the same location for once, I think that would be an awesome way to kind of commemorate, you know, over 7 years of actually this year it'll be eight years this summer after E3. Wow. Of this show, and I think that'd be awesome. It'd be such a different experience for us, because we're used to, you know, I'm sitting in my study like staring at the wall, you know, while I talk to you guys. So to be at the table all together in a professional studio where, you know, everybody's going to sound amazing every single time is something that it really made a big impression on me, getting to go there and be there in person and see how all that magic is made. Because it's like, you know, I feel like I've been around the block a few times on podcasting. You know, I'm on three different shows regularly, and I do this stuff a lot, but I had never seen anything like that. It was a whole different ballgame. Really cool.
Yeah, and keep in mind, though, again, the benefit of being in LA, because, you know, I had looked into using studios in San Francisco, and it was a whole other game. Because there are only a couple of audio studios there, so there wasn't much competition, you know. So the benefit here is that, you know, this studio was able to give us a really great rate because we were basically using free cycles. So they have a regular staff who's there all the time, and they want to keep them working as much as possible. So having a regular week in and week out, you know, spot is really valuable to them, especially then saying, hey, we'll give you a deal, but, you know, sometimes we'd have to move around because they'd be like, hey, you know, we have a full day recording session with, you know, recording artists. And so, you know, your studio's not available. And we'd be like, oh, okay, well, we'll do it another time then. What do you have available?
Well, I hope people enjoy hearing about this stuff. I find it super interesting, but, you know, I'm a podcasting guy in the first place. So it's very inside baseball, but I love hearing about this stuff. But let's talk about a game. We got a question from Nye First on NeoGAF in our official thread for RFN, and this person was asking whether or not you ever went back to play more Xenoblade Chronicles.
That is an excellent question. So I actually was never personally playing it. Ariel was playing it when we were together, and it definitely looked like something I'd be into. So here's the thing that I have now is that I don't have a Wii U. I do have a Wii. I do have the composite cables for it.
It's not plugged in?
It's not plugged in. Not plugged in because...
Well, that's the standard state of Wiis across the country.
So it's not that it wouldn't work. So, you know, I'm talking about AV equipment. So I have all my AV gear running through my AV receiver via HDMI because it's also an HDMI switch and running back out to the television. But... Mm-hmm. The way my television works, it has something that's called a audio return channel. So it can I can plug something into the television, and it can send digital sound back to the receiver through the HDMI cable. So
right.
I could run the Wii hooked up to the composite, and, you know, I just haven't done it. And I think actually if I do it, y'all, I don't know if you're going to be like upset about this. I think I actually might do Last Story first.
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
Because having watched both of them be played, like, Xenoblade is cool, but it looked really long, and it had a lot of grindy to it. And Last Story looked like it scratched exactly that sort of great character-driven, great development character, like, even the cool voiceovers. Like, this, everything about Last Story just made me, like, go, I want to play this game.
Yeah.
So it's more likely to play that than Xenoblade. And I guess part of it also is I keep telling myself I'm going to get a Wii U because I'm a huge Pikmin fan, so I want to play Pikmin 3. I mean, I can't believe I haven't played Pikmin 3. It's ridiculous that I haven't played Pikmin 3. Mea culpa. It is totally ridiculous that I haven't played that game. And I actually also, same sort of vein, really want to play Wonderful 101, despite, you know, the mixed reviews of it. I mean, that still is clever and interesting, and I love the stuff that Platinum does. And there's still the core titles. There's still the core first-party stuff. But it's just, you know, hours in the day. Yeah. I don't have an Xbox One yet either.
I hear you.
So I don't know. So Xenoblade, I don't know. And the other thing about Xenoblade is the longer I wait, the closer I get to Project X, right?
Right.
Right.
So
if you're realistic and you say, look, I only have time in my life to play 100-hour RPG on a Nintendo system this decade, maybe it's better to wait for the new one where they polish it up a little bit, you know?
That's
they make
a
it
lot
better,
of foreplanning. Right? This decade, I will only have time for one of these games.
I mean, it's about once a decade for me to play a 100-hour RPG, you know?
5 minutes a day, every day.
But I think you would like it, Garnet. I think Xenoblade, it takes a while to get into, and it is very sprawling. And at some point, it can be a little bit overwhelming because it's so open and there's so much you can do. But
yeah, the whole like side quest via, you know, steal from MMO idea.
You can really skip pretty much all of that. I mean, you're not missing that much if you skip that stuff. But even the main quest is gargantuan. And it's a game very much about scale. It's not only the scale of the world, but also the scale of the storyline and of what's happening to these characters. And it takes a long time before you really fully appreciate what's happening with it. It's not the most accessible game. That's why I say I think The Last Story is the way to go if you're only going to play one of them, or if you want to test the waters a little bit and maybe get back into it and see if you still have the appetite for a bigger game. I think The Last Story is an excellent way to go because it's so dense and it's so fast paced, and it's, I think, every bit as good as Xenoblade Chronicles. I mean, The Last Story beat it out on my Game of the Year list that year.
I think I'm probably okay as far as the whole visual thing goes. I mean, look, I'm a pretty diehard Japanese role playing game fan, so I think that I don't think that I'm going to get really overly uppity. Although I do really appreciate, you know, a beautiful game, and I think that.
Sure.
Art of Last Story worked really well within the limitations of the hardware.
I agree. And Xenoblade does too, but in a different way.
In a different way. Definitely a different way.
We don't know what The Last Story would look like on a new system, but we already kind of know what Xenoblade would look like in HD, and it's coming. So
it's coming this year, right, bro?
I'm not ruling it out. I know James is pessimistic.
Decisively ruling it out.
I will decisively rule it out with you. It's not coming out this year.
If Nintendo can't get that game out by early 2015 in the West, then their software planning really is even more screwed up than I already think it is. I mean, that's
I was waiting to see how you would end that sentence.
How crazy do you have to
even
be?
Just
to
keep in mind, like, regardless of the so the platform is an HD platform, which means the art resources are really gonna come up and bite them, and it's still a massive scope game, so it's not a small undertaking by any stretch of the imagination.
It seems that way. Yeah. I mean, that's what's exciting about it also, is just because, you know, there are so few games announced for Wii U, and even within that, a lot of them seem to be fairly small scale, you know, fairly contained.
Yeah.
You know, things, because Nintendo, you know, they only have so many people to make games. They, you know, there's only so many, very few, like, third-party and external studios making games for the system. So anytime you see something that is that epic, that humongous, or at least it seems that it will be that way, it's...
I mean, even 3D World feels contained.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah. So, it's still got that kind of, that whole diorama type thing, you know, it's... So, you know, when you see something like that, it's like very mouthwatering just because we're so starved for that kind of experience on the platform. But at the same time, it's scary because Nintendo so rarely makes games on that kind of a scale. I mean, really almost no one makes games on the scale of
I mean,
of
that's
Xenoblade.
That's sort of, I think, the reason they ended up buying Monolith Soft anyway. Because they do.
Yeah.
Let's move on to one more question for Garnet. This comes from Negator on NeoGAF. And said, I wanted to ask him if he thinks there's some kind of anti-Nintendo bias in most Western games press. Sometimes I feel as though they want Nintendo hardware to fail so they can get their games on PS4 or Xbox One without having to buy Nintendo hardware. Now, this might sound crazy, but this question comes up a lot, and I think among Nintendo fans, it's a very common sort of conspiracy theory, or at least a suspicion of some kind of bias. We've talked about it before on the show, but I don't want to taint your response by saying what I think about it or what we've said before. I'd be curious to get your fresh reaction to that.
That's good, because I don't want you to give me the taint.
God.
Cool.
So I think it's a combination of factors. First of all, I don't think that there are premeditated biases within anybody in the press. At the same time...
Well, biases are usually subconscious.
Yeah, so I do think that there's a lot of subconscious bias that goes on amongst the press. I think it's naive to look at the last few years of games media and not point to the reception, especially in the West, of the 360 and its association with how much it was the de facto base that every person in the press was playing on, right? And I think that to a degree, you could well see Sony enjoy that advantage during this coming generation, especially from things I've seen early on at a lot of demos, where now, you know, games that were always being demoed on 360 dev kits, now you're starting to see them being consistently demoed on PlayStation 4 dev kits. So yeah, I think you could see a swing of the pendulum there. And so I think that sort of naturally happens. And so, you know, carry that a little further. If you're a Nintendo fan, you've been locked out for a long while in all of this. Now, along with that, I think that most of the folks who are in games media are by simple virtue of how much work it takes to get into the business, the top couple percent of core game fans. And it's pretty hard to find a game fan who doesn't have, since we talked about soft spots earlier, I'll just use that same terminology, a soft spot for Nintendo, because Nintendo has been such a critical part of the development of video gaming, video game culture, everything we love about video games, right? So that soft spot, it's sort of that, it builds into that tough love mentality that sort of, you never get more frustrated than you get with those whom you love when they don't do what you want them to do.
And, oh, you're preaching to the choir now.
And so, yeah, I think I agree with this, because that would explain that all the DKC R2 reviews, the Tropical Freeze reviews, are basically half reviews of the game and half editorials on how you don't want to buy a Wii U now or something. You know, like, oh, this does not save the Wii U.
Which is absurd. Yeah. It's absurd. And to even say that Donkey Kong should say I'm with you on that page too. This notion, the fact that there are even articles being written of can Donkey Kong rescue the Wii U, it just defy the imagination. Donkey Kong, who would ever have thought that Donkey Kong would be a platform savior sort of product? That, you know, how many platform savior products does Sony have, period? God of War, Gran Turismo, I suppose you could argue, you know, depending on the era, Final Fantasy clearly was a big deal for them. And they've had others that are big, but you start to, you know, quickly erode off from that. Microsoft, we had Halo, you had Gears of War. It's not like there are, you know, it's not like you're counting off these massive Christmas lists of titles. And Donkey Kong, usually
they're like once in a generation kind of a thing. The system seller is, I think, largely a myth. I mean, you can point to sort of, you know, very rare cases where that's really a thing.
Yeah, and having played it, Tropical Freeze is an awesome game. It's hard, but it's a really, really, really good game. And to in any way sort of color that analysis or that, you know, color the reception of that game in, you know, some sort of larger picture of what should the Wii U be and whether or not this helps the Wii U really does it a disservice, because that's not the game's job by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
And it is a really good game. Yeah, I agree. It is a really, really good game. I've gotten a chance to play a couple of demos of it and was definitely, definitely impressed.
You know, I think when we've discussed this in the past, my recollection of the sort of consensus really came down to it being that the reason you don't hear multi-platform outlets talking as much about Nintendo as they do about the other platforms is because Nintendo isn't as accessible to them and they're not as open with information. And frankly, for, you know, especially this current generation of consoles, there aren't as many games to talk about. So it's going to come up less often, you know.
A lot
of times lately, when you hear people talking about Nintendo on even shows like Weekend Confirm, it, you know, it was usually about their place in the industry more than what's going on currently with the, you know, there was some talk about Mario towards the end of the year and Zelda, but there was, you know, sometimes long stretches.
Look at the Shaq News Game of the Year.
Yeah,
period.
Exactly.
But there is also some laziness there. There's some laziness there on the part of the press. I mean, make no mistake, the PR machine from big titles and publishers definitely dictates a considerable amount of what content you see across ordinary quote unquote sites.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
For better or for worse. And you know, before people just jump off the bridge and get all upset about that, the reality is that there are a whole lot of people who want to see that stuff too. So, you know, to say, oh, well, then why do you cover it? Well, you know, after game, let me pick a game. Like, so what's an upcoming Sunset Overdrive, upcoming exclusive for Xbox One. So the next time there is a Sunset Overdrive PR tour, of course it's going to get plastered across all the sites, because everybody really wants to see that stuff, and that is the point of access that will be given to get that, right? So you
right.
get that, and you're right, by Nintendo not being more aggressive and creating more points of access like that, then they're not as much in the enthusiast press,
mm-hmm.
but they've gone the other direction and done these Nintendo Directs, where they're, you know, they're saying, hey, we don't need that. We're going to talk directly to our Nintendo fan base.
As someone whose job has been to cover, you know, video games, do you feel threatened by Nintendo Direct? I mean, we've talked about that a lot as well, because it's a very strange thing for Nintendo to do, and I have sort of mixed feelings about it. Not because I'm an elitist and I think that people should have to go through me. But I feel like it is so disruptive of the way that we learn about video games. And at the same time, there's a service that the games media provides in terms of being a lens and a filter and a peanut gallery. I think that's valuable as well, that Nintendo has in a lot of ways circumvented with these Nintendo Directs.
Yeah, but
so I think there are a lot of pros and cons.
Who's that lens and filter working for? You know, who's that? Is that lens and filter working for the publisher and the developer, or is that lens and filter working for the audience? And I think that that's a tough question to answer. So, you know, look, I've had the luxury over the last 2 years of having most of my day job be developing mobile games. So
mm-hmm.
I've been, you know, for the most part, I was still, you know, talking to Andrew and the editorial team about what direction they were going and consulting on, you know, what the editorial direction for the site and so forth would be. But I wasn't in the day-to-day editorial. And I tell you what, stepping away from it has been awesome for me, because my attitude about where games media has just completely exploded from where it was 2 years ago. I think that 95% of what is being out there, and then what's out there right now in the enthusiast press, all due deference to my peers who engage in every day, is just sort of anachronistic. It's these old vestiges of a different time, still trying to find a way to express themselves in the way they always have, following in step with what PR wants to do. And that's fine. I think that there's still a space for it. I think there's still a call for it. But I'm not really interested in doing that. I'm not interested in just doing that. Do I want to go still to E3 and see the games and get in on those high notes? Sure. Do I want to go to every game demo and be just following, you know, oh, well, it's time for us to reveal the multiplayer component of our new game? I'm not sure I do, because there's some, you know, does more than one person need to go to that? Because what they're going to show and what they're going to tell will be identical to every single outlet and person they tell it to. You can, you know, look, they've gotten to be experts at this. You can come at it with as many different knives and guns editorially as you think you may have in your arsenal to try and knock people off their beat, but you're really not going to get that much juice. You're going to get what they've been what's been decided to be shared with you. And that's fine. I get it.
It makes me think of the Warriors of Rock demo they did at E3 2012, I think.
Yeah. No, it was 11. That very well.
And it was this, I know they gave the same demo to every single group that came through there, and it was awful. It was completely pointless, and you pretty much learned nothing. You learned it was Guitar Hero with Kiss face paint.
Yeah.
But it was this ridiculous over-the-top stage show they staged every single time. I refuse to believe one single meaningful word of journalistic activity took place as a result of that event.
So, you know, this is why I love, like, I totally love what's going on in the outside the ordinary space. Like, I love what's going on with the YouTubers. I love what's going on with Twitch. I think that interacting with the audience is freaking way behind the times, and we're going to ratchet it up and catch up in the next few years, and it's going to be a whole different ballgame. And if I were to stay in editorial, I think that the reason that would be that what's interesting about having someone like me to participate in these discussions is that I've seen all these games and have this longer, greater, you know, perspective and all of these different experiences to draw from, and can give that a good color and can bring it together and articulate it in a way that, you know, puts things together for people who don't have the time to do that all the time, which really, that's what I mean. The reason you picked up a magazine 15 years ago was because you were into games, but, you know, that was your source of information. But, you know, we don't need that source of information. Now we have the internet, but the internet now has gotten to this point where it's like this massive tidal wave of info coming at you all the time. So I think there's a tremendous amount of room to do really cool stuff that's not in just the traditional space. I think there'll still be people who do that, but, like, so to answer your question about what Nintendo does with Nintendo Directs, I think it's really cool, because what's cool to do with a Nintendo Direct is to look at the Nintendo Direct, analyze it, and then start having conversations with all the Nintendo audience about, like, okay, well, here's what I thought about this. Here's the historic perspective of what they've said. Here's what some of those developers they've talked with are working on. You know, actually, to tell you the truth, that's closer to journalism than just going and reporting what, you know, your latest PR fact sheet is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're probably, you know, right on the right track. And, you know, we just did that last week. You know, we started recording just a couple hours after the latest Nintendo Direct, and we had plenty to say about it. And what might concern me is that because everyone has access to this information all at the same time, there would be a trickle off in the interest level of what we have to say about it, because why would you listen to us and our interpretation of it when you could just get it for yourself? But really, that hasn't happened. And anytime there's a new Nintendo Direct and a whole bunch of crazy stuff gets announced, we immediately get all these comments from people saying, I can't wait to hear what you guys say about it. And I really hope that you guys didn't record until after that happened, so we get to hear you talk about
the dealio,
it on this week's
right?
show.
The deal is you guys have to do your jobs, or like, you guys, we have to do our jobs. We have to actually bring something to the conversation. We have to have a real opinion that can be backed up and have something to say, and not just be parroting what's been handed to us. You know, here's your script. I sound really cynical and critical. It's just I'm really excited about opportunity. Like, this is something that we used to talk about all the time, is like breaking out of the cycle. And, you know, especially if I'm just out here on my own, I'm going to be, you know, largely ignored anyway, so I'm going to be much like the person on YouTube or the person on Twitch. Well, not much like, I'm going to be that person on YouTube or on Twitch. And, you know, hopefully there'll be people who are interested and will listen, and we can, you know, we can be part of that movement to do something new.
Basically, you're Jeff Green now.
Sure. Jeff Green's awesome. I don't know if I could live up to Jeff Green's standards, but yeah, Jeff's Sure.
I go to see sites and I read things like Forbes and I see that they post just straight up press releases from any time they get anything from a technology company. Maybe they put their own headline on it. And I understand that many times organizations do this simply because they don't have the bodies to interpret what it is that this press release is about. They don't have the expertise or they don't have the manpower to do it. So they just straight up give you what they were given in an email, you know, one of the 8,000 emails they got in their press account that day. But I feel like that now that we're in this kind of place where that isn't really important anymore, that news is less important part of the job as it is to give more, provide context and explain what things mean and to have strong opinions. It's much more of like a, it's less the 8 o'clock news and more like the 9 o'clock opinion show. It's a weird place to kind of find yourself now because I may have all these facts, but they're not really all that important. They're only important insofar as they help explain everything.
Well, and you got to know which facts. You need someone who knows which facts are important and is able to pull them together and make some sense of them.
Right. Yeah, I think making the sense of it and providing that context is even more important than giving your own opinion. Because I mean, I'm happy to sit here for a couple hours a week and give you all of my opinions, but I don't know that that really helps anyone. I don't know that that's really useful to anyone. It might be entertaining to a degree, but what I would hope is that in the course of doing that, I can connect the dots for people and provide the background and maybe just kind of play devil's advocate. I know that's something you do a lot, Garnet, but hopefully provide people different perspectives so that they can find out what their own opinion is or better inform their opinion or maybe find a way to express it in a more nuanced way. That's really what I hope to bring to it, as I hope that it's not just us spouting our own thoughts about this stuff, but it's us helping to enrich the conversation so that people, and I think this happens, I hope it does, is that people will listen to a show like this or any show similar and feel that they come out of it not just like copying what we say, but understanding things in a way that they can then go and talk to their friends about these things. And as they do that, they hear themselves coming up with their own ideas and coming up with their own viewpoints on the topics that they've heard us discuss, because they, you know, we kind of help, I hope, show them what this stuff may actually mean. And also having multiple voices is so important, because then you get this cross-section of differing opinions and completely different backgrounds and different takes on things. And so then even if you don't agree with any of us, you can walk away from it and it's easier to put your own take on it, you know, and feel like you own it and that you understand it and that you have sort of absorbed and internalized that information for yourself.
I think the other piece that I came away with from being able to step away from it for a little while is that I don't really feel like I need to be, you know, right, quote unquote, about something.
Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of, you know, I'm cool with it. Like, you know, if you think that I'm wrong about an opinion, okay. If you think that I'm right, that's great too. And granted, it's difficult. It's very difficult in our business because you get so many times where, you know, battle lines are drawn and there's a right and there's a wrong and, you know, everybody starts defending their point of view. I get it. Okay. And I'm comfortable with that. And you know what? The next piece of that is I also kind of have gotten to a spot where I have to be like honest and say, yeah, you know what? Sometimes I'm going to say something and I'm going to have thought about it and I'm going to have an opinion and then someone's going to come back to me with a counter opinion. You know what? Maybe I'm just wrong, and maybe I need to listen to them, and maybe they have an opinion or a point that makes sense, and like there's nothing like wrong with saying, like there's actually something good about being open to saying, oh, you know what, actually, yeah, you're right about Devil May Cry. The action is really awesome, and it's stupid for me to get hung up on whether or not the character is the character that I want him to be.
Well, I'm glad that you're finally coming around. I never expected this much of a...
Yeah, they just need to admit that changing the character was a mistake and just sell DLC to fix it. Done. Done. Capcom, I've just made you like a 50% DLC sale on every copy of that game you sold. You're welcome.
Bam! Drop the mic.
There we go. I'm out. The other thing that I found to be really, I mean, I've been doing this now for 4 or 5 years, so not that long, but what I found that's changed things a lot is just having Twitter now, where I can say something here and I know what I said is going to get me maybe excoriated. And when it goes out 3 days later, the response I get from something, either I'll hear an idea, I'm like, oh, I didn't think about that. Or I'll be like, yeah, I got roasted for it. Or I'll get into arguments, or I'll sometimes find weird support. People who are like, no, I agree. That having that immediate feedback loop and being able to engage in conversation with the people who were formerly sort of anonymous consumers of what you say, it forces you to continually think about something versus just it's out. And once it's out, you can sort of deprogram it from your mind.
Yeah.
It keeps that analysis going pretty much every day, all the time.
Yeah. Twitter is my second favorite thing that's ever happened on the internet. And I've joked many times, although really I mean it quite seriously, that Twitter is the only iPhone game that I really care about, because it just never stops. It just keeps on giving. And the more you use it, the more fun it is.
Couldn't beat out Pornhub for you, huh?
No, actually, my number one favorite thing that ever happened on the internet was podcasting.
Ah.
Yeah. And it's changed my life, and you were not a small part of that, Garnet, but it really has completely changed the way that I socialize online and the way that I am able to contribute in my own way to the internet, and also the way that I consume information and media from the internet. It's so very different from perusing message boards back in the late 90s or something like that, and I love it.
I'm going to sound like the really cynical one here, but on the topic of Twitter, it's pretty cool to get direct feedback from listeners and people in general, and also getting this kind of privileged access to these conversations that other, like the people that you listen to on podcasts or like people in the industry are having. But at the same time, it can make one a little bit disillusioned about the video game industry. And, it's so easy. Like, people are having conversations that would probably be better off private sometimes. And it's so easy to retweet.
I think it just disillusions you about people in life.
And I think that, like, retweeting something stupid that someone said is so easy. And then you get a glimpse of how, like, these, I don't know, like, some video game journalists, I'm sure they're completely sincere in their tweet, but they'll be defending like their friends in the industry or something like that, or they'll be taking a stance against like the detractors of this game or that game, or you know, like there's like the debacle with EA and SimCity, and
yeah,
sometimes you know, like so the video game journalists because of it don't look very good and perhaps have lost, like sometimes they lose a little bit of credibility, or you kind of end up.
I think you definitely lose some credibility.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder, okay, like they don't seem to be standing for the consumer, so why?
But that's a decorum issue more than a platform issue.
Sure.
No, of course, yes. But like it's kind of like you see the underbelly, the seedy underbelly of video game journalism. for good and bad.
But see, that's not just video game journalism. That's journalism.
Oh,
in general.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I have friends who are professional journalists in very specialized trades, and I mean, they go to parties with the people they're supposed to be providing, you know, the fourth estate coverage level of. It's like, should you really be going to a party with this guy when it's your job to make sure that they're not doing seedy stuff? No, but it's at a really good restaurant, so you know, whatever.
I think it's actually much less cynical than that. It's so easy to become friends with these people because they're cool people. And, you know, that's maybe easier for me to say, having rubbed a few elbows in gaming, versus, you know, like real hard news where you're covering politicians or something like that. I have no perspective on that whatsoever. But I've been to, like, you know, Nintendo official parties at E3 where I get to hang out with developers, and I love that stuff because these people are so interesting and it's so much fun to talk to them and they're really nice, you know, and they are into a lot of the same things that I'm into. And, you know, professionally, I mean, it's funny for me to even say professionally because I've always done this as an amateur anyway. I just got to have some access every now and then. But for me, it's like, I don't see a problem with it because these are the kinds of venues where you meet people and you make these connections. It's really just networking. And that may lead you to have someone to call up when a big story comes around and you want to find out their side of it, or you want to find out what's their opinion on the matter, or if you're investigating something. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's part of doing your job is you should go to those things. You should get to know these people to some extent.
Yeah, and herein lies the conundrum that I have. I mean, I think that after my whole little rantish BS on PR is that, you know, I'm not saying that I think that there's no space to have a relationship with PR, because at the end of the day, you do want to have access to people. I mean, I still want to be able to talk to them. It's like, how do you balance that out? How do you balance out wanting to talk to a developer about their game with knowing that when you do talk to them, that they've been media trained and they're really only going to tell you what they're supposed to tell you?
Yeah. If you have half a brain, I think it's pretty easy to figure out when they're talking to you as a person and when they're talking to you as a representative of whatever organization they come from.
They're always talking to you as a representative.
Yep.
Yes, but it depends on the subject matter, right? So if I'm talking to you about the game that you're working on right now, I expect you to toe the company line, and you should, right? But if we're chatting about whatever else, that could be a very different situation.
It's tough. It's very difficult for anyone to also have the leeway within which to do that. I mean, that's why we didn't have a whole lot of guests on Weekend Confirmed, was because that was part of the that was part of the ground rules for someone coming on Weekend Confirmed, is that they have to know the show and be able to, you know, participate with the whole show and be cool with participating with the whole show.
Right. And some people don't have that, you know, convenience from their job, right? Yep, I hear you. Well, it sure has been fun talking about all this stuff, Garnet. We had some emails picked out, but I think it's better that we wrap it up here. It has turned into a nice little kind of feature segment about, you know, talking about games and the industry and developers and the media and podcasting and everything else. So it's been pretty wonderful having you here, sir. I really appreciate your coming on the show. You did the whole show with us. It's not a short podcast that we do, and I really appreciate you sticking around. And
I know, I got to go make some dinner.
Yeah, I hear you.
Hungry.
But I really appreciate it, man. It's been kind of a dream come true having you here on the show. I've been thinking about it and talking about it for a long time. And you met and exceeded every expectation I could have possibly had. So thank you so much. And best of luck with everything that you've got going on, everything coming up. And, you know, you're welcome back here anytime, of course. Anytime.
All right, well, let's just start another one right now.
Bonus content.
And now we can hear Garnet Lee eating spaghetti for 2 hours.
Yeah. Dinner with G. Lee. Yeah, so before we go, I do want to let people know that we'll probably have emails next week. So if you have a question for us, and we'll probably have a different special guest next week, so we'll let that remain a mystery for now. But the email address for that is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And I want to thank everyone for listening, especially if this is your first time, and I hope you'll come back. But otherwise, we will bid thee adieu and talk to you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Good fun, guys.
Bye.
Your next insanity to check out is Secret.
What?
Your next insanity to check out is called Secret.
Okay.
Is that an iPhone game?
Yes, it is an iPhone game, but actually it's an iPhone app that is
okay.
That's completely bizarre that basically goes through your contacts and everybody posts to a sort of timeline where there can also be pictures, but everybody is posting anonymously, but you know it's your friends. And the idea is that now you can sort of whisper secrets to all of your friends that you want to tell them, but be completely anonymous.
So holy you have shit. To guess whose penis you're looking at all times.
if you have to guess.
It could definitely go there.
Wow. Mm.